Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode, Behold the Monster. The biggest, the fastest, the longest of anything intrigues us. Many aspire to have their feats, no matter how trivial, immortalized in the Guinness Book of World Records. The record of most murders by a serial killer is no exception. And that honor goes to Sam McDowell Little. Starting in 1971 and continuing for 20 years, the FBI confirmed Little's involvement in at least 63 of the 93 confessed murders, the largest number of confirmed victims for any serial killer in United States history. My guest today is Jillian Lauren, author and journalist, who entered a modern version of the movie Silence of the Lambs to behold the monster. Come along with me as she tells her unique story of gathering confessions and details of scores of unsolved murders from the mouth of the monster himself. Welcome, Jillian.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
As I mentioned in the intro, that you are an author and a journalist, and that's how you came to this case. But why don't you fill my audience in a little more of the details of your bio, your checkered past, as it were.
Well, who I am? How did a nice girl like you wind up in a men's maximum security prison like this?
Well, yes.
All right. This is my fourth book that's been published. There's one practice book that will live forever in the drawer. My subject matter really has ranged, but always tends to be on the edgy side. My first memoirs is called Some Girls, My Life in a Harem, and is about the relationship I had with the Prince of Brunei when I was still a teenager. So it's sort of a tell-all of my coming-of-age story in a palace in Southeast Asia. I wrote another novel called Pretty. I wrote a book about adopting my son from Ethiopia called Everything You Ever Wanted, which, you know, still will always be my favorite book. And now he's 16 and he's read the whole thing. He's read the whole thing and he loves it. That's the one that I'll always hold in my heart. And then here we are, which is really my life's work. Behold the Monster, Confronting America's Most Prolific Serial Killer. There was also a documentary done about it by Joe Berlinger, who had recently did Dahmer, Bundy, Cecil Hotel. He just did Madoff. A friend of my father's, incidentally enough, small world, but Madoff, not Berlinger. So there's a documentary, there's a podcast I did with Michael Connelly. And the thing is that this serial killer, wasn't convicted in 2014 of long cold cases due to the fact that the LAPD got a grant from the Department of Justice to screen old evidence. And so they found a hit to this man named Samuel Little. They found a second hit. So now they're looking at a serial killer potentially. And this famous detective, Mitzi Roberts, I met with her. She is, if anyone's a Michael Connelly fan, and who isn't, she is the model for Renee Ballard. And the real thing is, even she's even sharper and scarier and more inspiring. She's fantastic. And at the very end of the interview, she told me, I said, "What are you the most proud of?" She said, "I'm proud of them all, but I did catch a serial killer once, and that was really cool." And I was like, "What are you talking about? I buried the lead. Tell me about this." I went home and researched Samuel Little, and, you know, they finally got him for 3 counts of murder. And he was spending the rest of his life in prison. And it was just this underreported serial killer case that Mitzi told me, or Detective Roberts told me, she believed there were far more murders across the country, but she was unable to mobilize the kind of interest she would have needed to for people to start opening cold cases in different jurisdictions, because these victims that Samuel Little picked were victims intentionally that people didn't care about. Marginalized women of color, sex workers, drug addicted, often prostitutes. You know, there isn't one rule, but there are women on the margins, women on the fringes, women in the shadows where he lived. And he traveled back and forth across the country. It was a transient. So that made him very hard to catch in the era before DNA, and still in this country with the lack of communication between jurisdictions.
In the beginning of the book, you point out to the reader that to sort of tell this tale through various sources, that it is sort of, I think the word you used, that it's a hybrid.
All the information I can gather, and then, you know, a hefty amount of imagination, which I explain at the very beginning of the book. This isn't going to be your everyday true crime. How do I know what the last words of these women's lives were? I mean, I've heard it from a liar, a killer, you know, I mean, whatever he wanted from me at the time, that was the narrative. And so I had to piece it together. And yeah, of course, I say in the beginning of the book, you didn't have to do this in Capote's times, you know, say, you know, this is a hybrid, an audacious hybrid.
Very, very beginning of the book issue, you sort of set things out for us, is a phrase that, I guess it's an exhortation to yourself or anyone else who might try to do something like this. I love it. It's perfect.
Don't go down in the basement, dumbass.
Right.
Why?
Which is always how I know I'm onto a story. Every time I have that tiny little voice going, "Don't go down in that basement, dumbass."
But what's interesting is that you did go down, and also this is, as people read the book and you make reference to it yourself, this is, and I went back and watched the movie, it's right out of Silence of the Lambs. Yeah. You weren't an authority, you know, you weren't a policeman or an FBI, but right. You went into the basement, and for good reason.
And I came with a sort of beginner's mind and learned a lot along the way, and made some mistakes, some that are, the book's not without humor. And a lot of it is at my expense.
In fact, there's a point in the book where you're describing how you like dump your briefcase and stuff, and things fall out, whatever. And you sort of muse to yourself that you're not Jodie Foster, but you're more like Lucille Ball in Silence of the Lambs.
You don't go argue with the FBI. That's not a good idea. Things like that, you know, because any story, especially if you enter these depths, right, you're going to have to be reaching for the humanity all around you. And part of that is the laugh, and part of it is, you know, a collapse, and part of it is, you lose your ability to concentrate, lose your ability to sleep, the nightmares, you know. And when you're saying, you know, I did enter it sort of as a beginner, but with a, you know, I had just written a couple of scripts that I had talked to a lot of gangsters. I've always been good at talking to a wide array of people. I think there's a sense that I love to leave my assumptions at the door. I love nothing more than to have my assumptions challenged. So, you know, people enjoy that in an interview rather than having people approach them, you know, with an idea of the article they were going to write. But sure thing, I didn't know this was the book I was going to write when I started. And I learned along the way, and I hope that in that I'm able to explain to the reader along the way. You know, I'm not writing from the perspective of a cop who already has these assumptions, has already had all these training. I'm learning about DNA as I go. I'm following aerial maps and flying to Pascagoula, Mississippi to talk to detectives and, you know, and ex-prostitutes. And, you know, and it really was a true adventure. And the horror in the story and the horror in just the interaction with this person, I like to think of now that I've had some distance from it as overshadowed by what I learned and who I met, you know, along the way, who was really surprising, impressive.
Well, you met survivors. You talked to survivors because thank God there were survivors. Mm-hmm. And a couple of them obviously figure in one of his trials because they to set up the prior bad acts, which a lot of courts won't even let them. But it depends on the court will let in.
You know, there were a couple that were let in. There were a couple that were excluded. There were two excluded witnesses, but the ones that were allowed, the evidence that was allowed from his surviving witnesses hadn't, that's not true. Some of it had been heard in a court and just dismissed. But Beth Silverman, DDA Beth Silverman, who prosecuted Chester Turner, Lonnie Franklin, Grim Sleeper and Lonnie Franklin might be the same person, and Southside Slayer, you name it, like in recent years, any capital case in Los Angeles, Beth Silverman's arguing it. And she says, get me living, breathing witnesses on this stand. Because otherwise, all I have are photographs of corpses. And here's a living man. And it's much more easy to sympathize with that. So she, you know, was able to assemble this group of women who somehow, even after they had been treated like dirt for years, give them one more chance and come and testify in Los Angeles. And their testimony was essential.
And there is in the book, which it sounds strange, but it's a respite after a while of this turning the page and what am I going to hear of courtroom? You have a transcript of a couple. I think there's at least one or maybe two of the witnesses being questioned mm-hmm. by Ms. Silverman, and her straightforward. You know, we all see Law and Order and we all see screaming and how dramatic Law and Order, and she was calm and you read her words, she asked simple questions and the you know, witness answered them was slowly. And we all know that at the same moment, this monster, behold him, is sitting at that table.
She faced the other way. They had to have a break. She faced the other way and had a victim's advocate sit with her in court. Because she couldn't look at him. And you know what was interesting is it took her twice to enter that courtroom. Her name is Layla McLean. She has now passed on. And she was a spitfire. It was Layla and Hilda were the two witnesses from Mississippi, Pascagoula, Mississippi, who lived. And they were closest friends forever, and they couldn't have been more different. You know, Hilda was very proper, like church lady, and Layla was still at it. She had three dates, I think, one night when she was in Los Angeles. And she was like, oh, yeah, honey, I'm still at it. I decided to let Layla's testimony, you know, I break it up. There was no dining room table in my house. You know what I mean? It was just like transcript after until my husband was like, honey, like we're eating. We're like, your son's sitting on the kitchen counter, you know?
You do what you gotta do.
It's almost winter, you know, like, can we have a kitchen table back? But you know, it was so much, and I decided to let that one chapter just be Layla, like have no editorializing from me in any way at all. Let her speak for herself. And I find it's very memorable for people. And the line that I always remember, and I've shared this with my doctor recently. I had a little medical scare. Everything's fine, you know, but it's amazing when you've been reading and advocating for women who had no healthcare, you know, and you have the best healthcare in the world. They catch it the earliest. They catch it you know, and I never fail to thank them. And say, I'll tell you, you know, that I just edited a trial transcript where, you know, the question was, you know, so you were in the hospital for 3 days and you had petechial hemorrhaging in your eyes. I mean, there's only a few ways that happens, but, you know, it's a blood vessels breaking in your eyes. And you couldn't speak and you had bruises around your neck. I mean, these are all absolute signs of strangulation. Did you report your injuries to any police? No. No, ma'am. Did you report your injuries to any doctors? No, ma'am. And she said, let me ask you that another way. Did any doctor ever ask you what happened to you? And she said, no, ma'am. Didn't nobody care about what happened to no black prostitute in Pascagoula in 1984? No, ma'am.
Now, Jillian, before we move on to your actual first encounter, how you came to even get to be able to speak in jail, in prison, to Sam Little, I do want to mention, I sort of didn't say this at the top, but your book is raw. Because your description of what he did, as you point out, is essential. We can gloss over it. And so I haven't said a lot about that, but at this point, I think it's important, and my audience can skip ahead about a minute and a half. I'm going to just insert in here a reading from your book that is the description by him of what he did to one of his victims.
I didn't have intercourse with her. I was getting off by just my ultimate desire. I sat down on the floor, leaning against the bed, both of us. She laid back, and she laid her head on the bed and let me feel her throat. Swallow for me. I love it when you swallow. She was putting her hands around my penis. She was jacking me off. And I squeezed her neck. And I had a climax, just like that. I strangled her there. Well, I was kissing her. I kissed her mouth. No, she didn't say nothing. After I kissed her mouth and was holding her throat and choking her, the only thing she did was struggle in my arms. She squirmed around and pulled at my hands. We were looking into each other's eyes, and I was loving that. I did that until her eyes got large as peppermint candy, staring up at me. I stared down at her. I bent down and kissed her again. She was looking desperate for air. I couldn't stop. Afterward, I shook her and looked at her and pushed her chest in and out, but she didn't breathe anymore. I ran my hands through her hair and smelled her hair, smelled her body, looked at her. She no longer was there, and she didn't know I was doing all that. I kept holding her, and then I took her out to the van and laid her on the side. I didn't want to run her over. And I eased out away from her body, and it was lying there where I left it on the side of the dirt road right off of Central Avenue. You can look out at that little bridge. I nudged her down the hill.
So, Jillian, tell my audience about your first encounter face to face with the notorious serial killer Sam Little.
So, what did it look like? What did it feel like? What did it smell like? It is an enormous complex. It's, you know, it I think it's meant to house 1,800 men, and it houses 3,000. It's in the middle of the desert, so, you know, the temperatures are punishing. You know, it's either freezing cold or burning hot, usually on the same day. There's like a mile and a half walk from the visitor's parking lot to the visitor waiting room. You have to get there at 6 a.m, which means I have to leave my house at 4 a.m. You wait online for 3 hours, then you wait online for another how many hours? I mean, it's like beastly, but of course, the first time it's still exciting because you don't know what's in the next room that you're walking into, you know. While we become acclimated to things very quickly, still that first time I was like all shaking and alive with adrenaline and, oh my gosh, am I really doing this? The last time I was in jail, it was in Livingston, New Jersey. I was 13 and they did a scared straight thing with me because I stole a nail polish from the Rite Aid. Yeah. 13 years old, they dragged me out of the mall in handcuffs behind my back in front of my friends, in front of the bagel shop where my friends were there. I have never stolen another thing in my life. But in any case, so I didn't know what was going to be in the next room. And it was very Silence of the Lambs with less sort of leaky stone walls. But, you know, a big gate opens. You step inside. It closes behind you. The next one opens. You walk in. And I just sort of followed the families to their blocks, and I knew I was going to B block. I hoped that was where I was going. I remember it was so windy and so hot, like my hair was all like lashed to my face, and I was trying to see, and all the sheriff's deputies are running by you and, you know, flak gear, and you know, I walked into this room and where are the telephones? Where's that glass thing where you do the hand? I was all ready for it. And it's a big room with like little plastic tables, like a kindergarten, and plastic chairs, and a giant area for Legos with AstroTurf on the side, and a porch you can walk out into if you have a certain amount of clearance, and a photo booth. Vending machines all around the sides, microwaves that are only for your visitors. Now, I was prepared for this because I know enough scumbags that had done time there. So I just called them in advance and I said, what do I need to know? They said, bring quarters, like lots and lots of quarters, because you'll need them for the vending machines. If you don't bring quarters, you're not cool. So I was like watching, mesmerized, as they're just these families and couples and around, and I'm like, where's he gonna sit? Was he gonna, you know? And I'm watching the line in front of me, and he rolls up behind me. He's in a wheelchair. He rolls up behind me and he's like, "You!" And it was a full jump scare. I mean, it was it was an actual jump scare. And you know, I won't say I didn't watch Silence of the Lambs 1,000 times before I went in there and had that kind of romantic image in my mind of what this transactionality was going to be. And that was partially quite true. And then also, you know, I studied interviews done with serial killers before. My aunt's a very famous psychiatrist. I have a ringer. So I didn't just walk in there a total greenhorn. But he did scare the daylights out of me that first minute. And then I just sort of was looking at him, and I'd seen the pictures and the, you know, and the newspaper articles, and there was just something very almost translucent about him, like this very palpable absence to me to begin with. And he said, "You're my angel from heaven. You knew I was lonely and God sent me you." And you know, his appeals were long over. I walked in at just the right time. He was just getting ready to confess to a Texas Ranger who is famous for being the serial killer whisperer. He just needed a Texas case. Texas Ranger Jim Holland. Yes. James B. Holland, Company B. And there's another character I never expected to run into. Like I said, this story has given me far more than it cost, I think, in the end. I don't know. Check with me in a few years. I still don't sleep so well most nights. But
before you come on the scene, how many others has he, in passing, either confessed to, or they're maybe sure he did it, but they haven't taken the trial yet?
None.
None. He hasn't confessed to anything but what he's been convicted
proclaimed
of.
No. He never confessed to those. He proclaimed his innocence. By the time I actually got in and was speaking with him, Jim Holland had already spoken to him. So he had, like, the dam was cracking. But when I first started writing him, no, he absolutely proclaimed his innocence. It was just there's a traditional sort of tension between press and law enforcement. And I'm sure the good Ranger Holland would have liked me out of his way. You know, no one wants a journalist up there, tush, when they're like really dealing with an open murder investigation. Michael Connelly says about the detective Rick Jackson, who I also worked with, who's Harry Bosch, that until he retired, he never said anything to Michael but no comment. So, you know, there's that traditional tension, but I'd gotten in there and I wasn't letting go. I lucked into the story of a lifetime. I was like, oh my gosh, here's the serial killer. He's starting to confess. I had no idea. I mean, the number at the sheer car, I had no idea how much this was going to snowball. But you know, I figured he was good for 15, then I was like 18, and then I was just sort of starting to go through the confessions, and I was like 23, 24, and then you know, there was months of confessions with the FBI and local jurisdictions, and 93 was what they came up with. And he often drew his victims as he confessed, so you know, there's a whole gallery works full of a whole gallery full of artwork of.
And what's chilling is in the back of the book, all books have photos, and yours is no exception. You have photos of those that you could get of the victims. And next to them, if they exist, is the drawing that he made of the victim from his memory. And I guess in some cases, that's very spooky to begin with, but in some cases it probably helped verify his confessions, because he would talk about someone he killed and they would either find the body or connect the case. And he had the drawing that he'd say, well, yeah, that's pretty good. That's close to what this victim looks like. Wow.
About how many visits, personal visits, not counting, you know, either a phone call or a letter. How many can you think of how many you visited with him?
30.
That's not approximate. Okay, 30. And now you're saying that at this time he's telling you things. Obviously you're giving, I'm assuming you're then giving this over to the authorities.
I don't call the police and say how he feels about his mommy. But when there were relevant details to murder investigations, yes, I did. I called the lead investigating officer. So I got in touch with Jim, and any tips that I felt were, or details, or anything I felt that was unusual, or that I hadn't seen in any of the FBI confessions yet. And then I would usually try to also get in touch with, you know, the jurisdictions that could have been, you know, say Miami or New Orleans, or, you know, and just see if they had a cold case department, see if there were any open cold. I mean, knowing that, you know, the FBI would do their due diligence on that too. But, you know, there were a few phone calls I've got during this investigation that I'll never forget in my life. They were incredibly meaningful to me. And I think maybe like you never forget your first or something, but we were at the Grammys. This is in the book. And you know, my husband and I always like to joke, you know, let's go lose another Grammy. So there's always that tension between, you know, I know that I'm in this sort of otherworldly and fantastic situation of being at the Grammys, and here's this person, and here's that person. I'm like, look, Zendaya, I'm running for the bar, you know, but
I'm sorry. You're at the Grammys for why?
My husband's a musician because okay, he was nominated.
Nice. Can you tell me?
Nominated for a bunch of Grammys. Yes, he plays bass for the band Weezer. So, so we were at the Grammys, and that was when I got the call that this piece of information that I had given the Texas Ranger had led to a solve in Omaha, Nebraska, Agatha White Buffalo. And like you said, we don't need to talk about the details that I was able to provide, but what they did was pinpoint a particular location, and also like position of the body, and ethnicity that hadn't been in the earlier confession. So they were able to solve that case, and I just remember hiding behind a column, and everyone was going in, and you can't be late at the Grammys because they will give your award away without you. They have a very strict schedule. So Scott just went in. I was like, I guess I'll find you. So, and I was hiding behind a column, and he was like, we found her, and told me, you know, Agatha White Buffalo, 1974, Omaha, Nebraska, you know, and they found her in this particular way. I was like, you really did? And he was like, Jillian, we really did. And I just thought, I did something. There was just this like, for all my shenanigans, and who knows why, you know, like I walked through that door, there are probably a million reasons, but it's not what kept me there. You know, there's probably some opportunism, probably some curiosity, and sort of, I always think a dose of revenge. Like I was like, I'm going to get this guy talking. I'm a victim of domestic violence. You know, I can win this one. Look at me. I'm all grown up now. You know, now, and one should always watch one's hubris.
You do point out in the first part of the book, and I will leave that for folks to read.
Yeah.
But you were a victim of domestic violence. That's the first sort of after preface and acknowledgement we get into that sort of gets us kicked off to that. So I think
so that was sort of the flaming sword of passion that I had with me. But then what kept me was the victims. You know, and I lived with them every day for many years. I live with them still, you know, their lives and just, you know, the importance of restoring their names, their dignity, and seeking justice for them. Once I began to learn about the scope of Sam's carnage and also began to delve more deeply into the lives of his victims and see how there was such a failure in our social justice system. You know, if you'll forgive a cliche, I was in for a penny and in for a pound. You know, there was no stopping me once I was on this trail. And, you know, and that there were personal reasons. My sort of flaming sword of, you know, I am a victim of domestic violence. And so I feel lucky every day to be here and have the voice that these women had taken away from them. And so it became a feeling of responsibility for me to at least try my best to restore their names, restore their dignity, restore their humanity. And bring some, if not closure, some sense of justice and just some answers to their families.
Well said. Now, I need to tell my audience, of course, that Sam somehow dodged the needle, was never executed. He died in prison just before Christmas in 2020 of COVID-related illness. And as sort of a Christmas present to you, he named you his next of kin.
Yes. So Sam designated me his next of kin. And I was perfectly clear with him, you know, why this might be advantageous. And I told him I was going to donate his brain. And I had this worked out with the top neuroscientist in the country at Stanford, at Irvine. And then I was going to make sure he was, you know, respectfully disposed of and that he wouldn't be alone at the end of his life. I'd stick around. And my interest was the brain. And that was a disaster because of course he didn't fill out the paperwork right. This is perfect. If you've ever dealt with psychopaths, this is perfect. You know, he ruined my life for like two whole weeks trying to deal with this thing, and then it never got dealt with. I mean, the brain was unusable by the time anyway, a year later, I get a call with an apology from the coroner's office, and they say, you know, we recognize that, you know, this was wrong, and we are going to send you all the stuff. And also, you know, we have this box of ashes here. An aside for any true crime fans who might want to mull this over a little bit, I haven't had drawn any conclusions from it, but there was no autopsy done. There was no autopsy done on one of the most hideous criminals in American history. He was really disposed of pretty fast, and I was not able to get my hands on that body. So, and he supposedly died of COVID-related symptoms in prison. So I hadn't talked to him in 10 days when he died. In any case, my 11-year-old was homesick from school that day. I got that call from the coroner's office, and I had no childcare, and I had to take his sweaty little feverish hand and be like, "Jovi, we're getting in the car." And I'm like, "We're going to a very interesting historic building in downtown Los Angeles. It's called the coroner's office." And he was like, "Nice, Mom. Real nice. This is my job." So we totally walked up, picked up that box of ashes. It's like a plastic box about yay high. It's about exactly the size of a bread box, I imagine, if I knew what a bread box looked like. But and I actually took the ashes out and weighed them because I was curious, and they weighed 8.2 pounds. And then they're in this box, and now we've moved them. I decided it was time. But it oddly didn't freak anyone out. They're just there by the sponges until I could figure out what to do with them. I got a safe, you know, and storage space and all of that, but and for the art and stuff too. And hopefully there'll be something useful to do with them at some point. But yeah, you know, I was like, this should be creepy or freaky or spooky or something. I never found any of my interactions with him spooky. I mean, there were moments that were scary when he was angry. Like he would rear up, and I thought it became clear that it's easy to forget when you're just talking to someone, they're another human, they're sitting next to you, like how capable this person is of just snapping your neck. And there were a few times he reminded me of that. That were really scary, but otherwise, those words are far too twee, you know? It's not the Halloween haunt. It's something deeply disturbing that I'll grapple with for the rest of my life. You have to sort of fracture your sense of identity and really compartmentalize. And I started to see the parallels between what I imagine what would have been his life and the amount of compartmentalization you'd have to do to be engaging in such extremely antisocial behavior and still be functioning in the world.
Which he did do. I mean, he functioned. I mean, it's not like he just, you know, kept killing
every minute.
And
he was a transient. He wasn't one of these who had like a family and a job and a, but he made it by.
Now, after this period of time, you say you're kind of dealing with it. The nightmares are less, or the feeling of memory is you're sort of moving on to your next topics or your next jobs, next projects.
Interestingly enough, you know, it changes from day to day. I don't think there's ever moving on. Also, I'm always advocating for the still unsolved cases. And please, I urge you to buy the book, look at the book, look at my website, and to see all the unsolved victims. And I have a TikTok, Jillian Lauren author. I'm Jillian Lauren at Instagram, and those are my primary. I think I quit my Twitter like 100 times, so I always have like 3 fans. But but check out my TikTok, check out Instagram, and I'm talking about missing persons. You know, maybe you know somebody, maybe you can help amplify the image, maybe you can just bring some awareness to the issue of, you know, people being treated differently based on you know, based on their social status, based on their skin color, and look toward, you know, Lady Justice having more of a blindfold. It's up to all of us. And so, you know, please follow me, and let's do it together.
Speaking of photos, as I say, there are many in the book. There's also drawings of your travel around from various states where cases were going on. There's a photo in the back that when I was flipping pages, it sort of just jumped off the page at me, and I'd love you to share with my audience. It's a picture of you and Sam standing there, like sort of posing for a camera. Tell us what that was all about, what it felt like. You're actually sort of holding hands.
Sam is in a wheelchair. And you can buy, like I said, there's a photo booth. It's not quite a booth. It's just a background. And then, you know, they have some of the trustees who will take pictures. Mm-hmm. There's a $2 token. Okay, so I got one. Sam and I go over there. He's rolling along beside me. This first day I met him. And I stand there. And he lifts himself out of the wheelchair, grabs my hand, and pulls himself up. So what you're seeing is not me shaking his hand. You're seeing him grabbing my hand and me pulling him out of the wheelchair. And I feel like my eyes look like Patty Hearst in that picture. Look at those eyeballs. I was like, oh, smile. But you know, I'm shocked when I look at that picture too. And then we adapt so quickly as humans, you know, it became my everyday. I'm sure glad it's not anymore.
I want to close with a quote from Goethe, who said, "Who holds the devil, let him hold him well. He hardly will be caught a second time." Unfortunately, for the fate of many women, Sam Little was caught again and again and let slip through authorities' fingers. On a somewhat light note, if there is such a thing, in my research, I found out that Sam Little was in a reformatory, the Ohio State Reformatory, when he was younger. That building is no longer a reformatory or a prison, but it was used for location shooting for the movie Shawshank Redemption. I guess Sam didn't get redeemed. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode, my loyal listeners. And if you did, you'll spread the word. Information about the podcast can be found at the podcast's website. And that address is www.murdermostfoul.com. And there you'll find an email link to me where you can leave suggestions, comments. I read all email. And so, until we meet again, take care. And for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.